Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I hope all of you are doing well and are having a good week. Hard to believe that we are at the end of the first full week to the month of October. Doesn't that seem hard to believe? But what I do find hard to believe is that the last time I was on the air with you guys, it was at the very end of September. And that was quite a book series topic discussion that was conducted, to say the least, regarding the book called A Signal Victory, The Lake Erie Campaign of 1812 to 1813. I was very pleased to see that all of you thoroughly enjoyed that series, and I have no doubts that many of you, if not all, learned far more about the Lake Erie Campaign than what the school textbooks had told us, say, 25, 30 years ago, to say the least. Well, I'm sure many of you have been wondering since the last time I was on the air with all of you, when, for starters, when was Kirk going to get back on the air again next? And secondly, what direction are we heading? And I do recall when I was on the air last that I had a very, very good idea as to where we would be going. And the good news is that I have been able to follow forward on where we're going next. So, by doing so, I know that not only will I be able to share with you all the story that we're going to be doing next, but also that it's one thing to be able to start the story, but also to know how to eventually go about ending it when that time comes. But, you know, it is important to not only do your research ahead of time, but it's also important to say to yourself, okay, yes, I've done the research, but can I do the story? Because the last thing I don't want to do is be on the air and present a story to you all and all of a sudden say to myself, wait a minute, I don't know if I can do this. And if I come on the air and say that to you guys, then many of you all are left to wonder, well, yes, it's great that, you know, Kirk might know a lot of facts about this particular event or person, but if he doesn't know how to go about going forward and executing the story, then maybe he shouldn't be on the air to begin with. Well, you guys don't have that to worry about, not just for this series, but I think it's fair to say for all the other series that I have been doing since the time I was first on the air back in June of 2020 when I first began podcasting. I don't know why I say all this, but it is important to be able to do what I've been able to do because, yes, it's one thing to know history. Yes, it's one thing to know about a particular person or an event which took place, but it's also important to be able to read about that, about the necessary stuff as much as possible, because without doing that, then it is hard to be able, it would be very hard in going forward and being able to present to you all a thorough account of what had taken place at a particular time. To me, that would it would be very awkward to do, but I think it would be fair to say that even the most seasonal or veteran of authors, whether it's John Grisham or Patricia Cornwell, John Meacham, just to name a few of the many well-known authors out there. Of course, I'm not going to compare myself to those people, but it is fair to say that even the most experienced and well-known of authors definitely have to do their research and homework ahead of time in every way possible before they start going about writing their books. By doing your research ahead of time, not just ahead of time, but by doing your research thoroughly, then you know that you can be able to go forward and conveying a story to your audience that will make them want to come back and read other books that, or I should say adventures that lie ahead down the road in the not so far distant future. Well, I do know that where we're going in this next book topic podcast series, we're gonna take a leap. Well, how big of a leap? Well, we are going to be going forward, not in the 21st century, but in the century before. But we will be talking about an event that that probably most of you all don't know about. But I will say that it happened almost 60 years ago. And at the time that it happened, it probably did not reach the national news. If it did make the news, which it did, only it would have been a regional event. In other words, the newspapers within the region would have presented the story behind what took place to those people who lived in the area, either not far from where the incident took place or somewhere within an exact geographical area range that they could relate to. I think it's fair to say that, like for when my parents were growing up, yes, of course, my dad has told me he can remember when his parents got their first television. I think my dad was probably about 6 or 7 is when he told me when he got his first, when the family got their first television. And of course, you only had 3 channels. And then just before midnight, a red dot appeared on the television. And it stayed that way until about maybe 7 a.m. The following morning. But we have to be reminded that when our folks were growing up, watching television was a family thing. If you wanted to watch television with your friends, you could, but more often than not, you were outside playing with your friends. But when you watched television, watching television was done so as a family thing. It usually was not just for the individual themselves. So when you got the news, you know, think about it. Back when my parents were growing up, yes, you had access to news, but not in the same way that we have today. I mean, even I myself can relate to that in a way as well. Of course, yes, I recall a time when coming through school when, okay, yes, the internet was around, but it was not in the schools. As a matter of fact, internet use in the schools did not probably come about until after I graduated from high school back in 1998, if that tells you just how old I am. But as for news, you had your newspaper, your local news stations. You had headline news, if that tells you anything right there, which came out in the early 1980s. That was the first 24-hour media news network. But you did have some news selections in terms of getting news that could have happened not just for what happened in a particular area, but around the world. But that was revolutionary for its time. But I'm not trying to get off track here, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that when my parents were growing up and when they got the news, it was one thing to get the news, but they didn't get the rest of the world's news. If they did get news that, say, happened across the country, you know, my dad, for example, has lived in Virginia all of his life. My dad once told me, Kirk, if I found out about something big that happened, say, out in California when I was growing up, there had to be a good reason for it. But at the same time, maybe it was okay that we didn't know about everybody else's business as long as it was not a threat to the rest of the nation or let alone to the rest of the world. So, you know, yes, there's nothing wrong with getting news from elsewhere around the world or, say, from a different part of the United States. But then we have to ask ourselves, is this really breaking news? Is it really this compelling that we need to know? But what I do know is that the story that we're going to be talking about in this next book topic podcast series, as I said earlier, is one that that most of you probably did not know about growing up. But it is a story that must be told. It's a story that pertains to accountability. It's a story that pertains to a struggle for survival. And not just a struggle for survival, but how we as individuals deal with something in terms of a situation that, for one, was beyond our control, and two, if we do survive, how do we go forward? How do we go forward in living a normal life? How do we go forward in trying to explain actions that were beyond our control, that were bestowed upon us, and how do we try to go about explaining this to other individuals who were not there, so that they may not be the ones rushing to judgment? So I think it's time to say that it's I think it's fair to say going forward that we go forward with the prologue to our new book topic podcast series discussion. And I will mention the title of this book series at the very end. So here we go with our lead off to the prologue for the new series. Accountability must always be something which should never get confined to just one element within an individual's daily life. Becoming an adult, which happens when young people turn age 18, is monumental. Why not? It's coming of age. You know, it does represent a sign of freedom. Yes, freedoms are great, but even with freedoms, there still has to be accountability. Am I correct? Sure, not only on a, say, national level, but even on a individual level. There still has to be accountability. So, yes, becoming an adult, which happens when young people turn age 18, is monumental. But how they choose to exercise the foundations bestowed upon them by their elders. Elders, folks, usually to me, would refer to parents, mom and dad. But it could also mean extended family relatives like aunt and uncle. Because I know in some situations there are young people out there who have sadly lost parents, whom sadly died in a car accident. And they are left to be raised by either an aunt or aunt and uncle, or in some instances, grandparents. So when we think of elders, it's more than just parents, to say the least. However, yes, for young people turning age 18, while yes, it's monumental, and how they go about choosing to exercise the foundations bestowed upon them can only be decided on within their own selves. I know that sounds a little vague. So how can we go about better explaining that? Well, in other words, it's always easy to assume that if any young person grew up within a safe home environment, that he or she would automatically turn out to become good adults. I always thought that. As much as we wish for this belief to always be held to the highest esteem possible, from time to time, however, we are constantly being reminded that the exact opposite can happen, even for those individuals whom weren't given any hope based upon circumstances beyond their control. So yes, it would be very easy for many of us to rush to judgment and say, okay, for all of those young people whom came from terrible homes, the chances are they will become bad people in society. Well, more often than not, it has been proven to be true where those individuals whom did not come from the best of homes, young people that is, have in fact been able to become productive individuals and turn out to be good people. It might be fair to say that one has to be willing to help themselves in order to want to not only get help going forward, but to become a better person going forward. I know some of you are probably thinking to yourselves, is this going to be a psychology 101 course? Are you studying to become a psychologist, Kirk? I will tell you right now, no, I'm not. But we just need to be reminded that it's often easy to assume that, okay, if one comes from a good home, that they will automatically turn out to become a good person. And I have learned, you do hear about it from time to time where you hear stories about people that you thought you knew. You know, all of us fall on hard times. All of us, nobody's immune from hardships, let's put it that way. Everybody has probably been told at some point in their lives that they weren't supposed to do something or become something that others thought was not possible, but all of us have been able to prove a skeptic or various skeptics wrong, and that's never a bad thing, regardless of the size of the obstacle at stake. But we just have to be reminded that even those who come from good homes can sometimes steer down the wrong courses in life and end up making decisions that are not always for the better, And as much as we want to believe that those individuals and who do come from good homes and yet make bad choices, we certainly do hope that they have the opportunity, by all means, to learn from those mistakes. But at the same time, we also have to be reminded that once they become age 18 and over, that it's up to them to be able to admit that, okay, I did something wrong and I need to get some help, but I also have to be willing to help myself. Sure, I can still have mom and dad or some other family member guide me in the right direction, but I have to be willing to go along in that right direction in order to get that help that I need so that, number one, I learn from the mistakes that I had previously made, and two, don't make them again, and three, can still remain a productive citizen in the greater society. So what if I told you all, my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners, that our next podcast book topic series discussion isn't about Psychology 101. Instead, however, our time machine going forward will be taking us into the 1960s, with an emphasis surrounding late November 1966. I'm sure this comes as a real surprise to you all. Why the 1960s? Well, it never hurts jump into an era of time that has not been discussed before. Before getting into the heart of late November 1966, it's important that we reflect briefly as to what America had underwent just a few years before. Interesting enough, in the year 1966, that was the year that my father graduated from high school. Hard to believe, 3 years earlier, in late November 1963, almost 60 years ago, folks, the American people underwent an ordeal which shook their innocence never seen previously, when President John Fitzgerald Kennedy got gunned down in broad daylight while his motorcade was en route to the Dallas Market Center, where the president himself would be giving a speech to 2,600 people at a sold-out luncheon. You know, it's interesting, I've mentioned about this, folks, because I have read I have read a lot of books about that terrible day from November 22nd of 1963, a.k.a. the Kennedy assassination. I've read a fair number of books on it. And I could tell you this much. I first learned about that event when I was 9 years old. And the reason I say that is because I turned 9 years old back in 1988. So I'm 44 years old, folks, but I turned 9 years old in 1988, so I'll tell you this much. I was born 16 years after President Kennedy was tragically assassinated. So that means I was born in 1979. But I remember as a child seeing news previews on television about the upcoming 25th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. So long story short, I started asking my dad various questions about where he was, how it impacted him. And so to make it a long story short, when President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, a great deal of innocence was taken from the American people that day. I probably could write a book on it if I wanted to. But what I do know is that for my parents, it was their 9/11. They lost a lot of innocence that day because there was a time, folks, when a president could travel in a motorcade without a bubble top on it. In other words, presidents could ride in motorcades, wave to the people, they waved back. And never would have thought in a million years that a sniper or someone from a high-rise building would want to take aim at the president. Well, as a result of that tragic outcome, one of the things that the Secret Service had to revamp in terms of its security was, number one, they would have to start placing security Secret Service agents in high-rise buildings. Number two, no longer would a president ever be able to ride in an open, topless motorcade without any, bubble top shield that could have protected the president. And number three, never would a president's route be advertised, motorcade route be ever advertised again in the newspaper. In other words, when President Kennedy made his way to Dallas, the newspapers had his route advertised to the public, so this way the people could get the best view of his motorcade making its way through Dallas. Hey, why not? You know, who wouldn't want to get a great upshot view of President Kennedy in the motorcade? After all, he loved seeing the people. He wanted to be near the people. But as we also have learned, there are consequences with getting too up close. It might be best for me to save this that topic for perhaps a podcast series discussion later on down the road at another time. But there again, as I said earlier, it is important to reflect on where America stood as a nation before late November of 1966. So anyways, yes, the American people underwent an ordeal that shook their innocence unlike never seen previously, sadly, when President Kennedy lost his life that day on November 22, 1963. For so many Americans, JFK represented hope. And although he was in office for only 1,000 days, and as his wife referred to it as Camelot, and it truly was, the Kennedys, I will have to admit, they did represent something that had not been seen for quite a while in terms of the Oval Office. It had been years since the last time a presidential family came in with a young family. Caroline was probably about just shy of 4 years old when her dad became president. JFK Jr., sadly the late JFK Jr., was not even a year old when his dad took the oath of office. But it truly was royalty. The closest thing to, say, British royalty, perhaps. But yes, he was in office for only 1,000 days, but he had gone above. He did accomplish a lot in his time as president for 1,000 days in office. But one thing that many of us probably have forgotten and do need to be reminded of is that he had gone above and beyond in trying to remove as many soldiers from Vietnam as possible, given the situation per his eyes became one which he knew inside wasn't worth sending thousands of young men overseas, not knowing if they would return home alive, safe, and sound. And just to make something real brief here, folks, this was something very contentious that he dealt with. And not to get into anything political, but there were those in the military that wanted to have a broad presence. And for President Kennedy, he had seen how previous countries like France had tried to colonize Vietnam only to have failed. He just knew in his own gut instinct that sending American soldiers over to Vietnam was probably not worth the time nor money for long-term purposes. Yes, we could keep a presence of troops there, but over time we need to start withdrawing these, withdrawing our troops, because at some point they're going to need to come home. Of course, that's a whole other topic for a whole other time, but I'm just giving you all the best 101 foundation right there. 9 months after Kennedy's death, the exact opposite took place per an incident which occurred August 2nd, 1964, Gulf of Tonkin, which brought about further United States involvement within Southeast Asia. Although two confrontations took place between United States forces and North Vietnamese torpedo boats between August 2nd and the 3rd, what followed afterwards, beginning August 4th, through deliberate altered intelligence, You know, as much as we'd like to believe that every time we gather intelligence on what is taking place overseas, or intelligence involving a dictator that might want to impose harm not only on his own people, but that on other nations around the world, whom, say, have business in a in the country where the dictator is ruling, as much as we always want to believe that the intelligence that is gathered is true and accurate, history has proven at times where intelligence did not always get everything just right. Maybe not just everything, maybe not so much getting everything right, but sometimes history has proven that intelligence was deliberately altered. Sadly, what happened going forward on August 4th was the result of deliberate altered intelligence on the part of the military, which persuaded Congress to go forward in passing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, enabling President Lyndon Baines Johnson, whom was John F. Kennedy's former vice president, with broad power to assist any Southeast Asian country whose government was believed to be in danger of left-wing ideologies which sought to eliminate private property and social classes, or what's better known as communism. The best 101 definition I can give you in terms of communism. Communism has many different definitions, but for those of you, especially young people who probably don't know a whole lot about the Vietnam War, I mean, I know basic stuff, but I'm not a how do I say it? I'm not truly 100% knowledgeable in the conflict, although I know a lot of basics about it. But what I do know is that North Vietnam was communist, whereas South Vietnam wasn't. If that gives you the most basic 101 guideline in terms of why communism was at the heart of was at the center of the issue here, and that one of the regions in Vietnam was heavily communist. Well, despite 1964 being the year which laid the cornerstone for America's further long-term involvement in Southeast Asia, aka Vietnam, Americans at home did see widespread progress unravel in the form of civil rights legislation. Hard to believe next year, come July 2nd of next year, 2024, will mark the 60th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So on July 2nd of 1964, the 88th United States Congress enacted Public Law 88-352, Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was very, very broad sweeping, to say the least. And how ironic, before President Kennedy was assassinated, he did lay the groundwork for civil rights legislation. He did so about, I want to say, 4 or 5 months before his life tragically ended. But luckily, his predecessor, whom was previously his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, did carry Kennedy's wish and seeing to it that civil rights legislation did get enacted. So Lyndon Johnson did have to climb some hurdles with Democrats, most notably Southern Democrats, whom filibustered the legislation for almost 12 weeks. I had done this research before being on the air with you guys. Southern Democrats had filibustered the legislation for 12 weeks, where they did everything in their power to delay. They used every kind of tactic there was at their disposal to delay the legislation, which to me, you know, was uncalled for. But Lyndon Johnson, he prevailed. He prevailed. He was not going to allow the Southern Democrats to overrun him. Yes, he may have had good, he may have known many of them from his days in Congress when he was most notably the Senate Majority Leader, but he stood his ground, and he was willing to make the ultimate sacrifice by signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which did prohibit discrimination on the grounds of race, color, religion, national origin, but also helped put an end to segregation within public facilities, public property, including public schools and colleges. And hard to believe, 10 years earlier, in 1954, the United States Supreme Court, under Chief Justice Earl Warren, the High Court had voted unanimously 9-0 that segregation was inherently unconstitutional. But yet, the sad part is we, not to get political, folks, but we just have to be reminded that even as much as we admired what the Warren Court did in 1954 by striking down Plessy versus Ferguson from 1896, that had said that they struck down the separate but equal doctrine, where it was claimed that both races of white and black did have equal facilities, but the problem is that not all of those facilities were truly equal. That's a whole nother topic for another time, but we have to be reminded that even though 10 years earlier there was success in striking down segregation, it didn't mean that deep southern states were willing to change overnight. There still was a struggle even in the years after. Yes, Dwight Eisenhower signed the Civil Rights Act of 1957. He even brought in the National Guard to quell the unrest in Little Rock, to allow the unrest was quelled as a result of the presence of National Guard troops that allowed 9 African American students to be able to enroll in a school that had previously not been allowed for them, but to do so under better circumstances. And again, folks, I'm not trying to be political. I'm just trying to tell you what I know based upon what I've learned from TV documentaries that can help get a better story in this prologue, because eventually, folks, we will get to late November 1966. But as I've said before, and I'd say it again, we also have to understand where we were previously. How about we go 1 year later, come early August 1965? The 89th United States Congress enacted into law the Voting Rights Act, which banned all existing discriminatory voting practices that had been in use amongst a handful of southern states after the Civil War. So think about it, folks. We finally now are putting an end to such improper practices, and the one that always has come to my mind, and I read about it in history books from years ago growing up, but there were literacy tests where various people were denied the right to vote if they did not take a literacy test or let alone pass one. And the questions that were asked were beyond absurd, but that's as far as I will go there. But Congress was smart enough in going forward where they had enough votes and they were able to, there were enough legislators whom were able to take a strong stand and say, hey, enough is enough, that we are going to end all improper voting practices, most notably the literacy tests, which had been used as a precursor to not letting those whom had been frowned upon for years not be able to vote. It would be fair to assume that America was moving forward as a nation in the right direction, despite going onward and sending troops into Southeast Asia, not knowing at the same time if the mission's objectives could get fully met. Prior to the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin Resolution going into play, opposition to entering the Vietnam conflict long-term had already been laid out. It's fair to say it was laid out even before John F. Kennedy had become president. But by 1966, protests over the war became all the more rampant, both at home and abroad. A good example from abroad came about on July 3rd, 1966, where 4,000 protesters assembled outside the United States Embassy in London over opposition to the war. Prior to 1966 ending, a Gallup poll got released indicating change for American public support, where it had previously stood at 52% in favor of the war, to a new low of 37%. Now Americans are beginning to wonder if this war was even worth going into. So obviously, this is a national problem. A national problem that's not only impacting families here right at home, but it's also impacting their sons, whom are far away, and even their daughters, whom are, say, nurses, whom are assisting the wounded day in and day out. Well, as public opposition continued to mount over Vietnam, along with questioning the government's state of accountability from a national standpoint, late November 1966, so we're going to switch gears here, folks. We're going to go from national now to perhaps regional, maybe local, but we're going to take a step downward. So I'm sure some of you are thinking, well, how in the world is accountability going to still be a focal point here if we're taking a step downward? Well, we're not taking a step downward in the bad direction, folks. We're taking a step downward in the right direction that still has relevancy. So here we go. Late November 1966 saw a 26-year-old named Dennis Hale, whom worked as a watchman along the Great Lakes, begin to embark upon a journey that would test his personal accountability unlike never seen before. When Dennis Hale arrived at the Bethlehem steel plant come the late evening of November 26, 1966, in Lackawanna, New York, outside Buffalo, past and present caught up right away. Leading up to late November of 1966, Dennis Hale had often missed the boat he was assigned to. Well, if you've missed the boat that you've often been assigned to, I'm sure others along that boat would have to wonder, is it even worth the captain? Is it worth the captain's time and energy to keep this fella on the boat? Isn't it fair to say that if he has missed more than once, that somewhere down the road he's just going to become an even bigger liability to the rest of the crew? Why should we have to suffer if he keeps missing? Why should we have to suffer if our captain continues to allow this behavior? And most of all, what if the captain continues to be lenient with him, but yet gives us all the grief in the world if we make a petty mistake? You do have to wonder, but at the same time, should we be judging right away? No. And of course, that's always easier said than done. So, yes, leading up to late November 1966, Dennis Hale had often missed the boat he was assigned to. But this go-around had much more riding at stake, given the freighter was scheduled for one more final trip. I tell you, that month of November is always the most daunting month for any ship out on the waters of the Great Lakes. Not just the ship, but its crew. One last chance to reel in some big money. One last chance to earn not just money, but to earn some other prizes that will carry you over into the winter before the new season goes into effect. November, that month, and I'll probably say it again in other podcasts down the road with the series, November, that month which brings uncertainty, for better or for worse, November being the month where nothing is ever certain. November being the month that has proven in times past where crewmen have lost their lives, all because they were asked to go out on one more journey. And in some instances where crewmen did survive a terrible storm, only to be able to live to tell the story for future generations. But for Dennis Hale, so much more was riding at stake. Not just so much that the freighter was scheduled for one more final trip, but for Dennis Hale, if he did not make the freighter's final season run, such consequences would follow, from forfeiture of annual bonus, vacation pay. Not just regular vacation pay, folks, but how about extended vacation pay? Which meant losing anywhere from $6,000 to $7,000. I don't know what that would be the equivalent in today's money, but back in 1966, to lose $6,000 to $7,000 in regards to losing, in regards to forfeiture of an annual bonus, regular vacation pay to extended vacation pay, losing $6,000 to $7,000, that's a big deal. Think about that money that could be that could go towards us, not only supporting your, if you're married, say supporting your wife and children for throughout the rest throughout the duration of the winter season. Two, think about money that could go towards fixing appliances at home, and three, maybe money that could be saved up to for a summer or spring or summer vacation. Or something that your child needs in terms of medical care. The list could go on and on. On top of concerns over money forfeitures, Dennis Hale was also upset that he had missed the Thanksgiving holiday with family. Okay, so he's married. But while at Lackawanna, the captain of the vessel which he rode on learned that another mission would be required in taking a load west to Taconite Harbor, Minnesota. Quite a journey from, say, Lackawanna, New York, all the way west to Minnesota on the Great Lakes waters. This sudden change in plans was attributed to another Bethlehem steel freighter having engine problems. Yeah, you never know when ships can experience something internal. It's fair to say that even vehicles, planes, trains, automobiles, even ships, they all have minds of their own when it comes to having mechanical issues. The freighter which Dennis Hale rode on would be making its 34th run of the 1966 shipping season. But she wouldn't be alone, as her sister ship, Edward Y. Townsend, went about replacing the injured Bethlehem steel freighter that was supposed to have originally gone. By the time Dennis Hale's vessel, which he was already supposed to have been on, arrived into Lackawanna, the bulk carrier couldn't unload her cargo right away, given two freighters were positioned ahead. Roughly on a given average, it could take up to 8 hours when unloading bulk freighter carriers' cargoes. And for 26-year-old Dennis Hale, an unexpected opportunity now suddenly arose from nowhere. Dennis Hale's home was not far from Lackawanna, New York, or I should say from Buffalo. His home just so happened to be 3 hours away in Ashtabula, Ohio, which is not far from the Ohio-Pennsylvania line. Ashtabula is east of Cleveland. Ashtabula is closer to Erie, Pennsylvania, if that gives you any indication of where Ashtabula is. So technically, if Erie, Pennsylvania is located on Lake Erie, Ashtabula, Ohio is also as well. Ashtabula is near other Ohio cities right on that Ohio-Pennsylvania line. Most notably, Canoe and Fairport Harbor, Geneva, Salem, just to give you an indication. So Ashtabula, Ohio, being Dennis's home, 3 hours away, one of his colleagues, who just so happens to be a deck watchman aboard the same vessel freighter, his name is 21-year-old John Groh. Dennis hitches a ride with John Groh, whom is a native of Erie, Pennsylvania. Long story short, Dennis and John, this go-around, went about underestimating how long the normal unloading procedures had normally taken place in the past. Instead, the unloading of cargo per their vessel did not take up to 8 hours, as it had previously done in the past, which now meant that Dennis and John were going to have to went about going to the nearest United States Coast Guard station, and which meant radioing their captain, asking for a way to meet up with the freighter on her first trip stop. Okay, folks, it's awkward enough now that Dennis Hale had has had issues in the past with not making it on time and leaving on time when the boat did. He's now in the same position, stuck between a rock and a hard place. Now, I don't know about his colleague, John Groh, if he's had frequent issues as well, but I think it'd be fair to say that nobody's immune from it, but it probably is also fair to say that some crew members make unfortunate habits or just have tendencies to be a little bit later or be late more often than others. Who knows? It just happens to some people. But Dennis Hale and John Groh, they have to radio. They went about radioing their captain, asking for a way to meet up with the freighter on her first trip stop. How ironic that Dennis Hale's excuse, he had to give an excuse to his captain, and his excuse this go-around, his story was that his car broke down while en route to Lackawanna. However, Captain Arthur Crawley excused both men despite their tardiness, given his vessel was already short-handed regarding crewmen numbers. So it's awkward enough that, okay, for Captain Arthur Crawley, that he's got some crewmen that have tendencies to be tardy, but now all of a sudden he's desperate for help. Could it be that those whom had originally been on the boat for previous trips have decided that they don't want to go out on the waters? They want to be back at home with their families celebrating Thanksgiving. They don't mind missing out on an extra bonus. They probably already do have some vacation pay. They probably have some extended vacation pay. But at the same time, they probably also know that if they aren't going out on this run, that they do have to forfeit other things. They probably do have to forfeit extended vacation pay. And they probably also have to forfeit the fact that they will lose out on a bonus. Are those people probably okay with it? Sure. But they have probably also been in the business long enough to know that there's a time to be on and a time to be off. In other words, there does come a point in time where by the time November rolls around, you have to make a decision. You have to make the decision that, okay, if you're going to be out on the waters some Novembers, that's fine. But if you want to be off the waters other times in November, that's fine. One way or another, you're going to walk away. If you live through the whole month of November, you will be able to reap in the bonuses, to reap in those extra rewards. But nothing is ever certain. And for some of these men whom were previously on this trip, they have decided to call it quits for the rest of the year. It's just one of those choices you have to make, but you have to live with it because nothing's ever certain. So Captain Crawley told both men to report next day to Mullen Dock near Windsor, Ontario. And Windsor, Ontario, that's a very nice place, to say the least. I've probably told many of you before that my wife and I spent a day in Canada over the summer. And Windsor, Ontario is not far from Detroit, Michigan. As a matter of fact, the Detroit River encompasses both Detroit, Michigan and Windsor, Ontario. If that gives you any indication of how close the cities are to one another. So yes, Captain Crawley tells both Dennis Hale and John Groh to report next day to Mullen Dock near Windsor, Ontario, as the vessel herself would be taking on a shipment of coal. Dennis Hale fully promised Captain Crawley he would be there for certain, come next day, November 27th, 1966. A second chance to prove his accountability to both ship and crew. Well, folks, our next book topic podcast series is titled the following: Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. That's quite a title, to say the least, folks. I think it's fair to say that this will be... I know I've talked about other shipwreck podcast book topic series via the Great Lakes. This one's going to be very, very powerful. But then again, the other ones that I've talked about, whether it's been the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the wreck of the Carl Bradley, November's Fury, all of them have been well worth talking about. But this one, to me, was, when I read it, it was very gut-wrenching and powerful. After all, I think it'd be fair to say if the title does mention one man's survival on the open sea, if that's not powerful enough, I don't know what is. But what I do know is that we have covered our the most fundamental of grounds in this prologue introduction to where we're going. And when I'm on the air again next time with you guys, we will be learning more about what is called Season of the Witch. Season of the Witch, most notably being the month of November. We will also learn about why the year 1906 is important. I know we've been talking about 1966 and also in the years that led up to 1966, but there is a reason why 1906 comes into play. I can tell you this much, it does have something to do with the Daniel J. Morrell and perhaps with that twin sister ship of hers, the Edward Y. Townsend. We will also discuss the presence of large freighters. In other words, we will learn why large freighters were being built at the turn of the 20th century. Because large freighters are able to do, I can tell you this much, large freighters will be able to do far more good than freighters of smaller size when it comes to transporting cargo from point A to point B across the waters of the Great Lakes. Well, thank you for your time as always, and no matter where you live, continue to stay safe, and I look forward to being back on the air with you all, and thank you for being such ardent listeners. So wherever you all may live, I hope you all have a good weekend, but most of all, continue to stay safe.